Today is Sunday, July 21st, 2013. My name is Melissa Burlock, and I'm a public history graduate student at IUPUI. I will be interviewing William McConnell, who is a lifelong member of Bethel AME. We are going to talk about his life experiences. Also present in the room is Donald Burlock, bereavement coordinator at Indiana University Health. This interview is part of the Bethel AME Oral History Project. The project supervisor is Dr. Philip Scarpino, who is a history professor and director of the Graduate Public History Program at IUPUI. Mr. McConnell, I would like to ask your permission to do three things. First is to record this interview. Second, to have the interview transcribed if we have the budget to do so. And third, to place the recording and the transcription in the IUPUI archives and special collections where they may be used by a variety of researchers and other interested parties. Do we have your permission to do all three of these things?
Yes.
Okay. So let's begin. Could you please state your full name?
William A. McConnell.
When and where were you born?
Indianapolis, Indiana.
What's your birthday?
January 13th, 1927.
Okay. Could you please state the full name of your father?
Albert C. McConnell.
And what was your mother's name?
Pearl Callista, you said maiden name?
Her maiden name.
Okay, yeah. Pearl Callista Dice.
What did your parents do?
Well, my dad worked in a foundry, and my mother was a household person, wife.
So, growing up, how many siblings did you have?
As far as I know, there was three of us living. But there was, I was told there was seven of us altogether. But as I say, three living.
Okay. So, could you please talk about your memories of growing up in Indianapolis?
Well, I went to grade school there in my community, which was Hallville. Went to 63, which is now a new 63, and I graduated from there. And later on, I went to Crispus Attucks, and I didn't finish. I was there for at least the 10th grade, at least.
Could you describe your teachers?
My teaching was very good. We had very good teachers at that time, and they were teachers that were dedicated to want you to learn, and they cared about you to learn, and they try their best to go, I think, out of their way to a certain extent if you were, they seen you were a student or aggressive student, to see that you learn, I believe. And they seem to not show any partiality as far as gender, you know, sex is concerned, girl or boy. And you got an education if you really wanted an education. You know, if you just went there and didn't want an education, it made a difference. But if you wanted an education, they would see that you got one. And like I said, they were dedicated. And I like most of my teachers for whatever subjects they taught. I really enjoyed them. And I think Christmas acts at that time, of course, at that particular time, Christmas acts was reason why, because when you did get it, when Negro students got an education, a good education, they had to go elsewhere at that particular time. They couldn't really go to Shortridge or Manual, you know, because they were somewhat, discriminate to a certain extent. And later on, that changed, you know, where that if you had the quality, you could teach at Manual, Tech, or whatever have you, you know. So that's the way it was.
What were the differences between your school and a predominantly white school at the time?
Well, I think I've never had the experience of going to a predominantly Caucasian school. But I think the difference might be that they put more emphasis on teaching or the subjects that they feel you had to know in the black schools, where that subjects that they didn't want you to know, like black history or something of that sort, they didn't want you to know, they didn't teach. But in black schools, they were more dedicated to teaching you most of the fundamentals other than extracurriculum if they thought they could do so.
Were you in any student groups while you were at Christmas?
No, I didn't. I was not. I was just a student, you know. I was interested in music at that particular time. And I enjoyed mechanical drawing. And I enjoyed gym. And also, what is that? Well, those are about the three major ones that I did enjoy, you know.
Let's talk more about growing up in Indianapolis.
Well, I grew up on the west side, and at that time, it was foreign, out in what they call Hallville. And Hallville, at that time I was growing up, had the neighborhood grocery stores. It had two of the best hardware stores for communities, you know, that hadn't developed or changed over otherwise. And it was a lot of foreigners. And I grew up with knowing other languages, although I didn't speak them. I grew up being around them, and which I was glad, because it made me feel that it was something I should know, you know, and something that maybe I had to, was going to be later on in the future, you know. So, and then Hallville had a lot of advantages, had local post offices, and different other things. It had drugstores within walking distance. And like I had said, it had neighborhood stores. It had, and we got along beautifully. You know, we didn't, most of your foreigners of Indianapolis actually settled in out there in, on the west side. They didn't settle so much on the northeast, But a lot of them, from what I can understand, they settled right there on the west side. And I think when the Spanish started migrating into Indianapolis, I think some reason why this might be the reason why you have quite a bit of Spanish population on the west side, on certain parts of the west side. Okay. Not all, but just certain parts, like West Washington Street. It's a large contingent out there. But we have a small amount in Hallville, you know.
Who are your friends growing up?
Well, one was business people who own car wash, and some of them were barbershop people, and some were people I knew that I didn't necessarily associate with, but we grew up together as a doctor, physical, you know, and people, you know, people of a friend of mine that I knew. He was very educated. He taught, I believe, at Hampton Institute. And he was one of the best friends that I had, really. And that's the kind of people that I grew up with people that wanted to strive to have something. So that's about the size of it.
What did you do for fun, you and your friends growing up in Indianapolis? What did you guys do to have fun, just to hang out?
Well, I'll say we went to the, like, shows, entertainments that happened at the Murat, or, of course, at that time, Clues Hall was just coming into existence. So we went to the Murat when there were shows and things of that nature, and that was worthwhile. And then we went to the theaters when there was good movies, you know, downtown. And some of them, went to the bowling alley, because there was about 3 bowling alleys out there at that particular time. And some of them went to the bowling alley. And of course they had one, I have forgotten whether you could actually go to the ones out there, or whether you had, there used to be one on West Street, Negro Bowling Alley. And I think a lot of people used to go there when West Street was West Street. And Mr. Disman, he owned about 3 of them out there in Hallville. And of course one of them now is actually a church. I can't think of the name of that church, but it's a church right there on the corner. Well, it goes all the way to about a fourth of a block, really. And it used to be a drugstore right there on the corner. No, it used to be a store, grocery store on that corner. Because it used to be a drugstore a little bit a block from there. And it used to be another drugstore before you get there across the street. And it was sort of the what you call fountain-like drugstore. Had the stools that you swirl around in. But we didn't go because I think, you know, even out there they had a little bit of segregation to a certain extent, because they had Now they had two movie theaters, but they weren't anything to rave about. They were just, you know, just places that I guess I never did go in, and places where they were nice, and where some place where you could go and sit down and enjoy a movie at that particular time. But like I say, I never did go, because they didn't want you to go, and I didn't really wasn't that interested in going, because I was going elsewhere anyway, to more popular places where it was really comfortable and nice. So that's the way it is.
So the movie theaters and the bowling alleys, they were segregated, you know?
Yeah, they were. I imagine that was all over at that, at that particular time. Because see, that was in 1947 and 1946, all up in there, you know. Because I was drafted in service. I didn't volunteer, because we had to be drafted at 18 years old. And I think, to me, they need to bring back the draft, because I think it gives the younger fellows more of an incentive as far as what life, what the responsibility and discipline of life is about. Because they seem to, I'm not saying all, it's not all. Some of them are, behave as they've been taught in the homes. And then there's some that, due to circumstances within the home, is the reason why maybe conditions are like they are. But I think they need to bring back the draft, so they will make them realize that when somebody tells you something, it's a rule and regulation that can be of use or help and not a hindrance to you.
So you were living in Indianapolis when you were drafted?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was here in Indianapolis, Naptown.
Could you describe your first couple of weeks in service after you were drafted?
Well, my weeks in service were what you call basic training. So we had to go through that. And then we had to go through of being documented as for our name, rank, and get our serial number and all of that. And then we went into our basic training, and then after that was technical training. And basic training was going through ammunition ground, where actually bullets were being shot over you. But yeah, live bullets. And they weren't shooting directly down on the ground where you were laying, but they were just above the ground, you know. But you had to stay under. You had to stay below, or kept yourself crawling like on the ground to keep from getting hit by one of the bullets. And they might have been rubber bullets, who knows? But they sound like they were real bullets.
Right. So you were So you said you did technical training after basic training?
Yes.
Right.
In other words, that's whether you want to have some kind of career as clerk or anything that was professional, that would get you into further training of that field when you got out. You could take more of it. But this is what technical training was all about, to further your ambition or further your education as to where you're going and what you really want to do,
So what kind of technical training did you do? Did you like learn
I didn't.
specifically?
I didn't take any, because I was really a cook, a quartermaster, so I didn't really follow up on any at all, because I didn't think I was going to be in there long enough to really take. I forgot what the requirements were. I think it was so many weeks. And then you go into, you're shipped over into combat. Because at that time, after you got through with your technical training, the war was over. Hostilities were over. Of course, when we went over, there was no hostilities. Like I say, everything had been declared. Japan had surrendered. What else? So much of the European
Germany.
theater of war was, we went over as occupational troops. And I spent a lot of my times in Europe, which we landed at when I did go over. We went from Camp Kilmer, New Jersey. From there, we went across the United States to Camp Beale, which is in California. And from there, we were supposed to go to the South Pacific, and we were there for a while. And orders come down for us to be shipped across the United States again. And everybody said, "Oh, we know where we're going now." See, because that was South Pacific. And when we were shipped back across, that was the Atlantic, so that meant European. And I know I was really glad. Because see, they were bothered with malaria in the South Pacific at that time. And some of the soldiers, I don't know whether they contracted malaria or not. But that's what the army was a little bit afraid of. The epidemic might spread, and they didn't want it to necessarily get to the soldiers, So that's even why I was glad that I went to Europe and didn't have to be even thinking about anything like that.
So where did you go in Europe?
Well, we landed at Le Havre, France. And then from Le Havre, France, we went to Germany. And we were stationed in right outside of Nuremberg, Germany. And I used to go from there, hop on the Straßenbahn, as they call it, and go to Nuremberg, because you know that's where the war trials was being held
yeah,
at.
Right.
Now we saw where they were, because you could see as you go on the a bus or trolley or whatever they call it, and Straßenbahn, I think that's what they call it. And you could see that, but you you couldn't go in, you know, because there was always a guard or something standing outside, so you couldn't go in. You had to just look on the way you get in there to see really what was going on or how it was kept. You had the official, you know, business. But otherwise, you couldn't go in. I enjoyed going to Nuremberg because I seen how things were, how so much of the inner part of the Nuremberg, just right into the downtown area, was torn up. And how at once you could tell it was a nice looking city, that part of it was. And you could see how people were just living as far as wartime. And it was really sad, you know, because your heart went out to, you know, you read about those things. Or whatever have you. But when you see them, then you really feel sympathetic. Because I felt very sympathetic for the soldiers who had to experience wartime in this actually combat field. I feel, although I didn't myself, but as I say, I feel sorry for them. And of course, I was glad that I didn't suffer any, you know, big injuries. But this is one of the things I would like to go back to Europe. I'd like to see what it's, how much they built up, because then the people were nice. The people that we were around are. Group was around. They were nice. They weren't hostile. They weren't. They treated us just like any other civilian. And we got along beautifully with them. So, because I had a German cut my hair. Yeah. My hair was long and woolly, thick then. And I had him to cut my hair. And our German, one of our, two of our cooks, I think, at one time were German. Now we had cooks, like this, some of the soldiers had cooking experience.
Okay.
And you know, if you went to, did our camp have? No, we didn't have a mess hall at that particular camp. We did when we got ready to go come back home. That's when we saw the mess hall. And there were mostly Negro cooks. And I mean, they were really good when it comes to laying out food. And so that's about the basic of when I was in Europe.
So what did your unit do? What were your assignments while you were in Europe?
Well, our assignments wasn't anything regular. Was only assignments were as to get up in the morning, be sure you've done that, meet regularly evening time, and other than that, there wasn't any real basic a sign that you really would look on the paper and say, now I've got to do this because this is what I've got to do today or tomorrow. It was no big assignment, you know, in that respect.
Right.
So that's about the way it was.
Right. What stands out in your mind about the kind of things you did?
Repeat that again.
What stands out in your mind about the kind of things you did while you were abroad?
You said what kind?
What kind of things or assignments did you do while you were in the unit?
Well, like I say, I didn't do any, didn't meet any special assignments, but other than just regular, like do in the kitchen, you know, do sort of what you call KP duty, or things of that nature. And that was about the basic of my assignments were, you know. So it wasn't anything
specific.
Right.
What was it like serving in a segregated unit?
Well, I got used to it. Because see, when I was inducted, as you know, Atterbury was segregated. Now, Atterbury is a training camp now, for that concern. But Atterbury at that particular time, and I'm not sure it is how it is now, was it to integrate the soldiers more, or how they do it now. But we went in, they separated us as all colored, as they call it, all colored troops, you know. And I really didn't feel any different or any strain being segregated in that fashion because they had already been, you know. So I didn't feel any difference in it. Otherwise, it just I said, well, I'll be so glad when the time comes when I can be integrated more like it should be. And so the time did come. The time come when I was discharged. I went to discharge at Fort Sheridan, Illinois. And at that particular time, they integrated us as, you know, and I said, well, it didn't make me no difference, you know. As long as you act like you got some common sense and act like a human being, you know. So it didn't make me no difference whether it was all us or whether it was all them, or I was the only one. I wouldn't want to have been the only one among Caucasians. You know. But I didn't feel any difference. But I was glad it was so that I could see that maybe but Illinois and Indiana are two different states. And I think that maybe that was the reason why we were integrated then. I was only in service for about 3 years. But most of my time was spent in Europe.
So during that time, how did you communicate with your family while you were in Europe?
By letters.
Okay.
By mail.
And Because you talk about your unit's supplies. So you talked about the food a little bit. So, what about your supplies and the kind of things you guys had over there?
Well, we had the basic supplies as far as food is concerned. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we had some wonderful cooks. Mm-hmm. The cooks were good. Mm-hmm. And they were pleasant and most of the time. Because they had to feed, you know, when you feed two or three platoons, or even a platoon itself, where you consist of, what, 40 or 50 or 60 men, then you're feeding quite a bit, yeah. So the food was very good. And it didn't seem to be any short of supplies as far as getting the food to you to prepare it for distribution as far as the soldiers were concerned. Mm.
What kind of things did you guys do for recreation while you were serving?
Well, you mean in the service or before we were discharged?
Before you were discharged. Yeah.
Well, like I say, for recreation, you either could go, if you were stationed near some town, you could get a pass to go out of town and stay for 2 or 3 days. Or on the base, you'd go to theaters on the base, or you would play some kind of volleyball or something of that sort.
Were the theaters on the base, were they segregated?
Ours was, because it wasn't nothing but Negro troops.
Right.
At that particular, that particular time, on the base, or in that particular area. Because that was a small town in right outside of Nuremberg, and there was the Opera House, which was first Opera House, and a lot of times they'd go either those who would like classics. I'd go to the Opera House and listen at the symphonic music and concert music and things of that nature. Or there was a, what you call USO, right not around the corner from that. So they would go there on probably weekends that you could go after your training and so forth and so on. You go there, USO, and you know, dance and things of that sort. So that's one of the, two of the recreations that you could do.
How often did you get a pass to?
Well, you know what? I have forgotten exactly, but I think it was on the weekends at least. And they would last like we went to, before we went to, went across the United States to California, we got a pass to go to New York City. And I've always wanted to go to New York City. And we went to New York late that evening. And so there was about 3-4 of us represented, myself from Indiana, and one from Philadelphia, one from New York, and one from some other place. So we went to New York that evening and went to the Savoy Ballroom. And at that time, Count Basie and Lester Young was playing at the Savoy Ballroom. And we enjoyed ourselves. We got to patting our feet and enjoying ourselves. And so one of the soldiers said, "All right now, come on, let's go." And I said, everybody said, "Oh, shucks." So that was a recreation, you know, that we were in service at the time, because we were just freshmen then, but I mean, that was still a recreation. And like I say, I wanted to see New York, and I still want to see New York. I was just hated that it was on a short notice, you know. Because I was glad that I got to saw my favorite band, Count Basie, and I sooner or later met him years ago. Met him here, I believe. I was introduced to him through one of the other musicians. And so I was glad of that part of it.
So you talked about being discharged in Illinois.
Yes.
Okay. So could you talk about your transition from being in the Army to coming back home in Indianapolis?
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't actually come home direct. Mm-hmm. I stayed in Illinois for, I think, a day. I stayed there before coming back here because of my aunt and uncles were there at that particular time. And my family was still here as far as my mother and dad were still here. But I wanted to stay in Illinois.
Okay.
Because I like Illinois. And of course that was near Chicago, Illinois. And actually that was some city that I've been used to for years and years and years. I've been used to there, so I wanted to stay there. Because it's just like, it's just, there's not a wide difference. Great difference. There's not that much of a difference between Chicago and New York, because they have the skyscrapers, and a lot of people that don't know history think that all the skyscrapers originated in New York, but the skyscrapers did not originate in New York. They originated in Chicago, Illinois. That's where they originated. So I stayed there, and then after a while, I come on to Indianapolis. Right.
Where did she stay while you were in Illinois? She stayed with your aunt and uncle in Illinois?
Well, I stayed with my aunt when she was living there on the south side. So I stayed there. And you could hear the roar of the L. You know, you heard of the L. You could hear the roar of the L. You could sit on her rear porch and see the L go by. And it was quite fascinating, you know, being a young man. All that was quite interesting.
Or the differences between Illinois and being in living in Indianapolis.
You said what?
What were the differences between, you know, staying in Illinois for a while and then living in Indianapolis?
Well, it's just the difference in routine. As far as city-wise, of course, you can't compare Chicago with Indianapolis, because there's really no comparison. Because when you get used to the L's, and when you get used to downtown, when you get used to the lake shore, you miss all that. Especially if you're continuously around that as you're growing up. You know, now if you leave it and you're not surrounded by that sort of atmosphere later on, it makes a difference. But when you, you know, you have it as you're coming up, and you intend to enjoy it as you're coming up, it makes a difference. Oh, yeah. And it might feel that you might like one area better than you do the other. Not that you, well, one area might offer a little bit better. Because you know, when you got a job, if we got jobs where you couldn't find them here, hardly, you had to go to out of state, you know, until later on, before they start moving the factories to overseas and this, that, and the other. You could find a job, but otherwise than that, it was hard, you know, because people were losing their jobs. And it didn't make sense that they were sending so much of that work overseas, because we had some major tool and die. Now, they used to be here in Indianapolis, and they used to hire quite a bit. And there were several other plants that, but they moved them overseas, or they went out of business, or whatever have you, you know. So that's where it's not so much, I think, where you have a faster pace of life as the movement is concerned. But it's just what's there that keeps you intact, or with what's actually happening or going on.
So where did you work when you got back to Indianapolis?
Well, I worked in a factory. I worked in a foundry. I worked as housekeeping in a hotel. And those were the, well, I worked as housekeeping, I think mainly when I got back, and then the factory, and then the foundry. But I always kept a job. So that's about the size of it.
Do you remember what factory, what kind of factory you worked in?
Like, what, well, did you do? One was where they manufactured what you call bearings. I forgot what they were. Those bearings were for, but I used to work in the shipping room on South Harding. Yeah, South Harding. And I think that, I almost had the name of that factory in my mind. But I think it's still there. And I worked there for a few years. And then I worked in housekeeping for almost 7 years. Worked there where the, what's the name of that place? There on Meridian Street and, Meridian and what is that? Market?
Okay.
Yes. Where across from Chase.
AT&T? That you said was housekeeping?
Yes.
Okay, at a hotel?
Oh, yeah. It's across from Chase Bank now.
Across from Chase Bank?
Oh, I can't think of that.
It's okay. That's, yeah. Those are clear directions, so I can.
Right.
There, yeah. Mm-hmm. So where did you work after doing housekeeping at the...
Well, I had sort of retired.
Okay.
In a sense then, because I got arthritis.
Oh, yeah.
And it got me so bad that I had to... had a doctor. And I didn't work for quite a while, you know. So I kind of retired in a sense.
Okay.
Which I didn't want to, but I did. So that was about it.
So where did you live when you got back to Indianapolis?
Well, I lived right out there in Hallville.
Okay.
At the family estate. Which is still there now, on North Persian Avenue.
Okay.
I lived there for quite a while. And I'm here because of physical situation. But the family home is still there, and I'm looking forward, hopefully, to go back to the family home.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Could you talk about your family home? Like, what was the neighborhood like you were living
well,
there?
Well, the neighborhood was people that I think work together and they try to help one another. They try to look out for one another. When in sickness or in health, you know, when you're gone or when you're sick or even in the crisis, they try to do what they can to see what they can do for you at that particular time. They're mostly... caring people, you know, because mostly everybody is church going. They have some religious aspect, some kind of faith or other. Because, you know, out there on the west side, we have just about every denomination in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Catholic, Protestant, foot wash, Methodist, Church of God in Christ, I said Orthodox, and what other? Like I said, it's about every different church you could think of out there.
So, did you start going to Bethel right after you got back to Indianapolis?
No, I really belong to St. Paul Baptist Church, which is on North Sheffield. I belonged to there for so many years. And after so many years, I started visiting Bethel. And I started going to Bethel.
Okay.
And I like Bethel. Because at that time, the pastor that's there now, he wasn't there. Because I've been there now under two different pastors. Yeah, two. And I admire Pastor Grady. I think he's a wonderful, wonderful speaker. And I think he's just a wonderful, him and his wife, Mm-hmm. Both are just wonderful, beautiful people.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very, I think, would you say, mm-hmm. I think you can say articulate
mm-hmm.
in how he does things,
mm-hmm.
what he says and what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he really is sincere. So I joined there after so many years because I belonged to St. Paul Baptist Church there on North Sheffield, which is, they have church, but their real church that we used to worship in has been abandoned for several years now, but they have a new place, which at one time was a nursing home, and so that's where they are. But I've been with Bethel over 6 years now.
Over 60 years.
Over 6 years, and I don't intend to go no place else.
So why did you decide to start going to Bethel as opposed to...
As opposed to Baptist?
Yes.
Well, like I say, I just started visiting Bethel and I like the atmosphere and I just enjoy being there. Just as much as I did the church I grew up in. But, you know, I don't let differences bother me in that way because everybody's going to have a different opinion about how to do it. You're not going to please everybody. Somebody's going to be displeased. I don't care what you do. So it wasn't that case with me. Like I say, I just like being there. And I like the fact that they had organ music.
Okay.
You know. And they were a church that actually had a great deal of educated teaching. When it comes to learning about the Bible. And because it used to be one of the billboard churches out there, Bethel was. Because I don't know whether you can remember or whether you know, but years ago, that's where all your professional people went. But that was Negroes, especially. And quite a bit of them went there. That's when Bethel was in its heyday.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's when it was. And you know it used to be where they helped the Underground Railroad. And you know, I was surprised at that. I used to think that that particular time, there was a railroad running underground.
Yeah.
And I think so many other people thought the same thing. But I learned different later on. So anyway, that's the reason why. That's the basic reason why I like going over there, you know.
Were you a part of any men's organizations at Bethel?
No, just
Men's
just,
Day? Or?
No, just the choir.
Okay.
I was, I was with the choir at the old church, and I decided to get into the choir when I got to the Bethel. So, I joined the choir and I've been in the choir ever since. Now I'll participate if they ask me to participate in different things if they ask me. But otherwise, I haven't really participated in any major things other than just the choir, you know. Because they have all the trustees and whatever organizations that's helped to run the church. They had already had them in place, you know, and it's been pretty much the same. Even now, it's pretty much the same.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When did you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?
When I was 9 years old, Bob. At the old church at St. Paul Baptist.
St. Paul Baptist. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how do you think your Christian faith has influenced other aspects of your life?
Well, I think it's strong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's weakened mm-hmm. a whole lot. I think it's strong. I still believe in Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
I still have the faith. And I don't feel that I should stray too far from that, even as old as I am.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I should try to get stronger because I've gone through a physical thing that I wouldn't want nobody to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And I know if it wasn't for the man above, I wouldn't have come out of it three-fourths as good as I have so far.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to lose. You know, I don't want to become what you call atheist.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at a program today where it was real good. This family, strong family in Europe, had wanted this person, she wanted to her daughter to marry a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
But this fellow that she was going with, they found out he was an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe in a religion. So I think she either married him or she married someone else that was Catholic. So that's about the size of that part of it.
Okay. Let's just talk more about living during the 1950s and 1960s. Let's talk more about living during the 1950s.
50s?
Mm-hmm. I think you were in your 20s when the Korean War started.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I had been let's see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was discharged then.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that was, I was discharged then. 'Cause
mm-hmm.
I was only there in, I got out in 47,
mm-hmm.
or latter part of 47 or 48.
Mm-hmm.
I think the latter part of 47.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Korean War started,
mm-hmm.
I was out of it.
Yeah.
And I had heard about it, but I had heard too much about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I knew I was going to be reassigned, even though, let's say, I would still have been older now.
Mm.
But I wasn't going to be reassigned to go over there, although they were still drafting.
Mm.
I believe in 1950, I believe they were still drafting.
Mm.
But I was just glad I didn't, because that was a war. That was a senseless war. I never could understand why it was fought. So I was working, I'm sure, at the time, doing something, or either traveling, running back and forth, because that was at the time the trains were running good, and I was always on the go, going someplace.
What stands out in your mind about the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement? Does any specific event stand out in your mind?
Well,
do you remember? Do you remember learning about Emmett Till?
Yes, I thought that was tragic.
Yeah.
Emmett Till, I thought that was a tragic event, and but I'm so glad that so many of the civil rights people all over the country united themselves together, regardless of whether they were from the North, whether they were from the East or West, they united with the South in a united effort to make things better. Because that thing, type of thing, was just a senseless move. You know, and his mother, I think she should have told him better that, all right now, we're going to a different place. You're not in Chicago.
Yeah.
I think he should have been informed better, because I don't believe he was a child that was hard-headed, or you couldn't, belligerent against his parents. I don't think he was that way. But he just should have been informed better, you know. Because at that time, what were they were, they had things going on with blacks that still shouldn't have gone on, you know. So, and I think, like I say, I think the civil rights movement should be carried on as long as there's injustice among people, because the United States has said we practice one way, but who do they practice it for? Where is the justification for? Is it just, it seems like it's one-way street. It's not a full leverage of balance. It's not even balanced as it should be as far as opinion is concerned, or thought is concerned, or as far as legal aspect is concerned. And so I think civil rights is still, as long as it's participated in a decent way, not where it becomes violent, or because I think you don't do anything but hinder the cause that way. But as long as you peacefully march, which you have legally can do so, and as long as you're not obstructing justice, I think that it should be in a solidary way among the nation all over.
When you were growing up in Hallville, Does your parents inform you about how to interact with whites when you were growing up in Havre? Or
you said, did they inform me about whites?
Yeah, about how to interact or in public with whites.
Well, they only taught us that people were people, and there was no difference in color as long as, because color is only skin deep, but everybody should be, as long as they're human, they should be treated with respect and decency and courtesy and patience, understanding, and love. That's what my parents taught us. They taught us not to disrespect anybody because the skin was this color or whatever have you, or you know. They taught us to respect everybody because they are human. And it's how they behave themselves as people.
Do you have any memories of being discriminated against in public?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, because we went downtown. I went downtown. I was working. I forgot where it was I was working. I was working downtown in Indianapolis. And this gentleman was foreign extraction, I think. And that was when Blocks was there at Illinois Street. And when there was a Hags or Hooks drugstore across there in that corner. And it had an upstairs to it. So he says, come on, let's go. As we went in there, went upstairs and sit down. And when we sit down, we waited for a few minutes. And I think he said, well, what's wrong? Where is the waitress? Waitress wasn't that far away. But she didn't want to wait on us because I was there, you know. And so I think when she did come up, I forgot what she said because it's been so long ago. When she said, we don't wait on integrated people, or whether we don't wait on blacks or not, or what is she, I forgot how she said it, but anyway, when she said it, when she got through, he said, well, if you can't serve me, if you can't serve him, you can't serve me. So we got out and left. And that was my first time encountering discrimination outward. Because I never, you know, out of all the times, as I say, most of the population out there in Hallville was Lithuanian, Polacks, very few Jews, what else, Germans, and Czechoslovakians were settled out there. And we didn't have no discrimination. My friend was from, that I used to sometimes talk with, or just have a little brief conversation with. He was from Yugoslavia. And we got along just beautifully. So we didn't have no problem, period. So that was the first. So after that, I didn't have any more of a problem with people in that respect. So that's about it.
Okay. Who was your friend who sat in at the counter with you?
Huh?
Who was your friend who sat at the counter with you? You said he was...
I don't forgot who they were.
Mm-hmm.
You mean at a soda counter?
Mm-hmm.
I don't forgot who they were. Because they were different ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So lastly, let's just talk a little bit more about, it's like growing up in the 60s. Did you watch Jackie Robinson play for the Brooklyn Dodgers?
Did what now?
Did you watch Jackie Robinson play for the Brooklyn?
But you know, I never did care.
Okay.
I had watched him very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I admit it one time.
Mm-hmm.
But I admired his effort. I admired his willingness to fight over odds like he had to do at that particular time.
Right.
And so I never did actually watch any of his games that much, but like I say, he was one of the persons that I admired during that time as far as trying to get ahead and trying to make it the path easier for those who wanted to get into the baseball league better and make it easier. I admired that about him, you know. So... because I thought, even watching briefly like I did, I thought he was a wonderful baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful attitude as far as sports was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an example.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much an example for the younger people who has to come over behind him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was an inspiration to them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I think about him.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to take a short break, and then I just have like a couple more questions to ask, but that's it.
Oh. Yeah. I won't guess.